talking to Steve Bell in his home in Pacific Palisades on, what's the date today?
October
29th, 1994. As I warned you, I'm going to start by asking you how you first became associated with KPFA.
Well, we're talking here about the period, it's a relatively short period of time, 1960 to 1962. And actually, I think it was more 1960 to 1961 than even 62. I had been a member of the Harvard radio station, which in the late 50s was a very respectable professional organization. And I was part of the classical music department as well as other departments. And we thought we were hot stuff at that time. We would pronunciation would come from the most proper BBC lists, and you know, the sin of mispronouncing an obscure composer was banishment from the station. So we were quite proficient, and we were into all sorts of obscure things and preserving the past. And it was quite wonderful for a student in those days to come under the spell of that group of people.
At a time when commercial radio had nothing comparable at all.
No, we were pioneers. We were setting a standard for the future that never came to pass. But as any hopeless enterprise, we were hardy pioneers. We were really quite taken with ourselves. I left Harvard in 1960 and came to Berkeley. And I found, to my surprise, that there was an institution on Shattuck Avenue called KPFA, Pacifica Radio, that, if anything, outdid what we were doing at WHRB in Cambridge. And it outdid it in a way that was quite interesting because of its breadth of programming. Generally speaking, the Harvard radio station was primarily a music station of various kinds. There was some news, but not much. There was very little public affairs.
Was there any music that was recorded live or recorded for the station as well?
Yeah. There were things like that. And then they had the things called orgies during reading periods, you know, where they did 24 hours of the most obscure composer you could ever think of, every Haydn symphony, every Mozart Kärcher listing, you know, things like that students tend to do. But then there was some sports and there was some, live concerts and things, but primarily it was recorded music. But to suddenly discover KPFA, where the range of activity on the air was so vast, I mean, it was astonishing. So I kind of walked in, I guess, off the street. I felt sort of, a kindred spirit here over the air. And I surely, because I didn't know you and I didn't know anyone else who was associated with KPFA, I was looking for friends. I was looking for a home. And I volunteered.
Was it Glenn Glasso?
It was Glenn Glasso. I remember the one thing I do remember. I remember walking up the stairs, and at the top of the stairs somewhere was his office, and I introduced myself and I explained what it is that I had done and what it is that I would like to do, and I couldn't believe it. He actually, welcomed me, in a way that I found, to me, it was symbolic of California. As opposed to the East Coast, where you have to go through 20 years of apprenticeship before you get an assignment. Well, I must say that when I look back on it, the assignment he gave me was not an enviable one to the general public. But for me, it was heaven. What I did first was I had to produce and introduce the 1961 Bayreuth Festival ring cycle. Listen, it got a cover on the folio, so it was a big deal. And
a big deal. And this was actually the first thing that
I did.
The station.
Yeah. I did. And I'll tell you something. I remember it distinctly because in the same way that I used to do, classical music programs at WHRB, I kind of dove into it with such fervor that I wanted to be nothing short of the best, the most learned, commentary, the most sophisticated approach to it, the most intelligent, way of presenting it that anyone had ever done.
Did you have experience with razor blade editing at this point?
Yeah. I have.
So you did that for yourself as well.
Yeah.
I mean, you trimmed the announcements off
exactly.
and put your own on.
But in those that you got to remember that we're talking about a time when there was only one major recording of a Wagnerian opera out on LP. That was Schulte's Rheingold, the beginning mm-hmm. of his Ring, and the mysteries of Siegfried and Goethe Dämmerung were yet to be discovered. And here, thanks to the Broadcast Foundation of America, I can't remember the fanfare they used, but I remember I used to cut it off because it was, because they spent so much time.
By that time, I have to say that BFA was under Eleanor McKinney, who was one of the founders of KPFA.
Well, but of course. But I'll tell you something. I went to the music library. I listened to what recordings were available. I read up on the subject, and I listened obviously to the tapes, and I just looked recently at my scripts. Now you might find this interesting because I sort of find it interesting. I saved them. Why did I save them? Obviously, after 35 years. Is it 35 years? Wait, 70, 80, 90.
It's
35 years.
Yeah.
After 35 years. There must have been a reason why I put them aside. And I think the reason is, like anything else in your life that you spend time on and you're proud of, you kind of want to save them mm-hmm. as a memory of a work well done.
I have to intersperse at this point, talking to Alan Rich this afternoon and talking about his time at KPFA. He told me that the time that he put in as music director at KPFA, that he feels now that he dedicated himself more thoroughly to that job than to anything that he has ever done since.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it has something to do with the spirit of the times at KPFA. I have no real knowledge of before and after. I can only tell you what I did as a volunteer. And that was a category, obviously, of great importance to KPFA, since the people who were on salary were very few, relatively speaking. And to crank up this massive enterprise. I mean, again, I looked at the folios that I had kept from those days, and I look at the programming, some of it obviously from, from BFA, some of it from recordings, but a lot of it live, and a lot of it tape, and a lot of it originated by KPFA. Oh,
and a full-time equivalent, including secretarial and janitorial, of about a dozen people.
Yeah, I didn't know there were that few. No one told me that. I think they wanted to keep control. but I must tell you that there was a spirit of excellence, a striving to do the best that you could possibly do, and that there were actually people there who knew good from bad. And that's something you don't run into.
And not only knew it, but could produce it as well.
Yeah, exactly. So here I was, I 3,000 miles from home in this strange, exotic land of Berkeley, California, producing classical music programs as a volunteer for KPFA. I was in heaven. That led to a regular series. And it was another program that I think had been pre-existing, Treasury of the 78. And I was the latest sucker, I guess, Glenn Glasso thought, to assign to this task.
And I have to throw in, and I was your successor when you left.
Were you? Wonderful. But, obviously, for me, this wasn't a bum assignment. This was, again, heaven. And that's what I did was I went to the the University of California at Berkeley Music Library, where I met you, I think, for the first time. Someone, I think, recommended that I look you up there. And I went through the card files. And I found all kinds of goodies. You know, those were the days, you know, it's so funny to think back, but in the 60s, with all of the LP, you know, activity that was going on and all of the recorded music on LP, compared to what now we have available on CD from past performances, there was only a fraction then of what we have now. So that there was huge, you know, chunks of repertory, huge chunks of you know, the significant recordings of certain artists, huge chunks of composers, you know, that were just unrecorded, except on 78s, that had not made the jump to LP. Well, again, in the same pioneering way that I was going to teach Berkeley and myself about The Ring, I also felt that I was going to bring, you know, these wonderful 78 RPM performances that had not been transferred to LP to the radio audience.
And for those days, the archival holdings of the 78 collection at the university were quite remarkable.
Believe me, you could pick, you know, all kinds of things, and you know, you could sort of reach out as I did, you know, in certain areas. And it's funny, I looked at the scripts again before, you know, we met, and my goodness, they were very enterprising programs. I couldn't believe it. I was quite surprised. They were very well researched. They were very well chosen. I mean, for example, there was a Mahler program. Now, you know, Mahler in the early 60s had just come off of the centenary, and you know, the pioneering work of Leonard Bernstein and others, you know, had suddenly made Mahler fashionable and listenable. And yet there were many, many things that had not been recorded at that point. And so I took, you know, things like the Bruno Walter Das Lied von der Erde with you know, Charles Kuhlman and Kirsten Torborg, recorded with the Vienna Philharmonic in the 30s. And I, and an engineer, and I don't remember if this one had repeats, that must have had repeats, you know, on the end of the sides and at the beginning of the next side. And what we did, of course, is we trimmed the repeats so that it was one continuous piece of music. And
which, as I told you, I did the same thing after you left with the Mahler second.
Exactly. It was a wonderful exercise, and the performances were extraordinary, and the fidelity, you know, after we got through with them, was wonderful. And they made some wonderful shows. They had good equipment.
They had good playback equipment. They had Ortofon, broadcast arms,
they
with
really
78
did.
Stylus, separate heads.
But you know what they had even more so? And I don't remember his name, but there was one engineer that I was usually assigned to. And, you know, generally speaking, this was painstaking work. You know, and it was really more than just engineering work. This was musical work. You know, you really had to know, you know, when the beat came and when you should clip here, and that if you lose a beat, the whole thing won't sound continuous.
I think it's likely to have been George Craig.
Possibly. And I'll tell you, he did a remarkable job. And there was such tremendous pride in the workmanship when we got through. We did. I think I might have done probably 10, 12 programs, mm-hmm. 10, 12 hours.
There was also a very fine tube equalizer called the Pultec.
Yes. I remember that.
One was able to do very subtle noise reduction without losing musical content.
Now, there was something else. Now, it's coming back to me. When a friend of ours, Dale Harris, came, this was a guy that I had met at WHIB at Harvard when we were both students there. He came out to Stanford in the, I guess, about 61 or so, to teach English at Stanford. And during the San Francisco opera season, that 1 year, we decided to take a tape machine and record interviews with any number of people who were singing in those seasons. Again, this was a logical extension of all the things that we had done mm-hmm. when we were, had mm-hmm. been at the Harvard radio station. So there we were in the Huntington apartments, that very fashionable apartment building on Nob Hill, interviewing Elizabeth Schwarzkopf in what will remain to me one of the most hilarious interviews that I've ever experienced. You know, where she stopped the interview in the middle because she had something that Dale had said, you know, offended her, and she said, "That's not true. That's not true. Stop the recording." I'll never forget it.
Do you remember the opera that was the subject of the of these interviews?
I don't remember,
because I did.
You were there too.
I did a series as the recording engineer.
I think you were there
going
too.
Out with him.
Yes,
and it was on Strauss's Capriccio.
No. Mm-mm.
Well, I did do one with him.
You may have. That may have been later.
And Schwarzkopf was one of the people interviewed.
Yeah.
And it was called The Unanswered Question.
Oh, yes.
Oh. Well, which he did commentary, and we put the whole thing together into a documentary.
That's later. That's after I'd left. But I'll tell you something. She was the most offensive human being that I've ever run into, mm-hmm. you know. And later on
she was as well.
Ah, horrible. but it was a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. And here I got to meet all of these people, you know, that I'd never met before. And again, through Pacifica, through the opportunity. Mm-hmm. It really was...
That was where I met Rary Grist for the first time
uh-huh.
on this Capriccio,
yeah.
whom I later knew
yeah.
much better but through a mutual friend.
You know what it's like?
It's
analogous to a Mickey Rooney, Judy Garland movie. Mm. You know, let's put on a show in a barn.
Uh-huh.
Pacifica gave us an opportunity, all of us, mm-hmm. to basically... you know, do what we wanted to do. You know, it gave us an outlet for searching for things that seemed interesting, for capturing things and to produce things and to say things, and in a way that no one else could make available time to do. It was an extraordinary opportunity for all of us.
And as you will remember well from your own experience with radio, the one reason that these people gave us their time was because people who came from radio to ask questions of those days asked such stupid questions.
Exactly.
As soon as somebody like Dale opened his mouth,
exactly.
they realized they were in the presence of an intelligence rather than an idiot.
Exactly. But you know, there's something else you have to remember. The KPFA was part of something quite extraordinary that was going on in the Bay Area in the early 60s. Remember that this was just one element of a cultural life that was probably richer than at any time, you know, before or since. You know, you had the San Francisco Opera under, you know, Kurt Herman Adler, you know, for me, the greatest couple of years ever with any, you know, regularly performing opera company in terms of repertory, choices of casts, conductors, etc. Amazing. An amazing time and an amazing period for the San Francisco Opera. You had the Berkeley scene, you know, with all of its political ramifications. You know, I used to, you know, talk about it as it was like a pot boiling, mm-hmm. you know, ready to overflow a couple of years later with the free speech movement.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was the time between the hoses being, turned on to the mm-hmm. protesters.
1960.
In 19...
The 1960, the City Hall steps.
The City Hall steps.
UN.
And mm-hmm. and... 1963, I think, where the whole thing
movement.
Exploded.
Yeah.
But I mean, it was like Russia before the revolution. It was like everybody, you know, at what was the student union, you know,
Sproul Plaza.
You know,
yeah.
Buzzing with the excitement of what was to come. Mm-hmm. You know, there was the incredible literary scene, you know, post Beat, you know, literary scene. With, you know, Lawrence Ferlinghetti and the City Lights Bookstore,
yes, under the general leadership of Kenneth Rexroth.
Rexroth, who was on
a great guru,
and
who
was on KTLA.
Yeah,
and you know, when you add it all up, and of course the for me, what I'll always be grateful for is the presence of the Cinema Guild and Studio, you know, under the direction of Pauline Kael, the then unknown except for local Pauline Kael. Mm-hmm. And so what you had, all this incredible art scene, and by the way, let's not forget UC Berkeley, which at that time, and I know it from the music, from the English department, you know, where I was a graduate student, all of the great, young, talented, you know, minds and teaching talents had been attracted at that time to UC Berkeley from all of the great, you know, Eastern universities.
And Tom Parkinson.
Tom Parkinson, who
was intimately associated with KPFA as
well. And they were...
And a bridge between the university and North Beach.
Yes, but all of the talent that was attracted, because, you know, the situation in the East... You know, tenure was impossible. Politics was impossible. But here, with all of this great money that UC Berkeley had at the time, they attracted the best and brightest. You know, in their fields. This was before, of course, you know, then Governor Reagan, you know, knocked the shit out of you know, the budget of UC Berkeley, which, of course, it has never recovered. You know, since. And then, of course, architecturally, and I mean, social, everything was it was all there. And the reflection of that incredible, I mean, do I romanticize it? Perhaps, but I think it was all there. I really do.
Mm-hmm. Well, architecturally, as you mentioned, just coming being discovered, Bernard Maybeck,
and
what's her name? The woman that the architect that was so good. Yeah, can't remember. Anyway,
but you know, it was all reflected on.
It was real native art.
But it was all reflected on KPFA.
Yeah,
and so it was not unusual in those days to have you know, a movie review by Pauline Kael, you know, pre-New Yorker, pre-publication, you know, Pauline Kael, to have book reviews by John Leonard, you know, pre, you know, CBS, you know, Sunday Morning, pre-New York Magazine, etc., John Leonard, to have you know, concerts recorded at you know, at the music department
Hertz Hall. Yes, with a direct telephone line that we had permanently installed
A noon concert on, you know, live. To have you know, Broadcast Foundation of America, Vienna Festival tapes and Bayreuth Festival tapes, and have the latest in you know, in recordings and of course, you know, incredible documentaries, you know, by Elsa Knight Thompson and the best in news broadcasting and commentary and you know, a radical point of view that was really kind of you know, unable, you could not find it anywhere on the radio band. What an extraordinary time it was.
Yeah, and it dated to a time when political radicalism was intellectually distinguished,
yes,
and was worth listening to.
And we're talking, but by the way, let's not forget, we're talking about the early 60s in the Bay Area. I mean, this was Haight-Ashbury, this was the Flower Children, this was all the things that became nationally so significant, you know, in years to come. And it was all there, and KPFA reflected it and shaped it in so many ways.
And at the same time, you remember, musically on the station, also we're getting together the first instances of Jerry Garcia and Phil Lash of the Grateful Dead.
Yes,
coming together for the first time on Gert Kirito's
rock music, folk music, you know, all of that.
Mm-hmm. Did I tell you that I must have told you yesterday in conversation that John Meyer, the greatest sound systems in the world, that I find that he came out of KPFA and his first association with the Grateful Dead was there,
So have a lot of people come out of KPFA.
Yeah, I have to put in somewhere. I think I need an appendix in the book with just a list of the people that came through that place and what they subsequently
did.
Right. And it could be it would be long.
Mm-hmm.
Right. It's funny. You've been brilliant, by the way. This is what you said.
I'll tell you something interesting, though. That I discovered after I left, because I see for me those years were graduate education, the decision not to become an academic, the decision to go back east and try to make a career, make a living in broadcasting. In the East, which I did, but I found something really kind of sad attached to all of that. That when I got back to New York in '62 and started pounding the pavements looking for a job, and when I interviewed with a lot of people in the broadcasting business, I discovered that it was different from the way it had been. At KPFA at Berkeley. And I really must tell you that I have never discovered anything quite like what had been at KPFA, in the 60s. I think it was totally unique. Unique to its time and place and the people who were, who were attracted to it and the people that it attracted to itself. Certainly not in commercial radio. In New York, certainly not. And it was, I mean, that in itself is kind of, it's sad, but it's significant because WBAI certainly wasn't in terms of, what it sounded like on the air, what its programs were like, what it represented in the community, certainly was nothing like what KPFA was to Berkeley in those days. And that always surprised me. And frankly, I can say the same about, KPFK in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. And I've lived here now for 13 years. And it's not there. It doesn't have a significance. There is no impact, like there was for KPFA. Maybe it's because Berkeley was smaller than both Los Angeles and New York. But it was more than that. I mean, the FCC always, when they wrote the Communication Act in the 30s, talked about, public service and fulfilling the public interest. I have never known a broadcast institution that reflected and served its community in a way that KPFA did. Mm-hmm. I have no idea what the ratings were like. I have no idea how many people listened. But boy, you really got the feeling when you broadcast something that people were out there listening and that they heard.
Yeah. It served the community without being subservient to the community. Oh,
certainly not. No. No, certainly not.
Yeah. It was that sense that Lou Hill asked for, demanded at the very beginning, that KPFA be representative of the intellectual leadership of the community.
Well, it was very much on the British model.
Yeah.
And I think all of us in the 50s were in some dim way, I certainly wasn't doing it consciously, because I probably had never heard the BBC except in snippets. And I certainly had never lived abroad, and I never had the experience of, a resource like the BBC, close at hand. But we were kind of copying the model of the BBC, which, and as I take the model to be not pandering to its audience, mm-hmm. and not following its audience, but. Mm-hmm. Inspiring and leading
its audience.
Nor being
condescending to its audience at the same time.
And that's something that, in the commercial world of broadcasting, has disappeared. the idea of, and certainly it's even disappeared, you know, in public television. I think the only thing that is close to what KPFA was for me is NPR. That's the only thing that is even vaguely approaching that.
But they have moved so much in the direction of commerciality.
Yes.
In their,
as public television has.
The tone.
Exactly. And also, it's so limited. I mean, it's so narrow, actually, in its range of interests and what it does and the programs that it broadcasts. So narrow. It's the breadth of KTLA. It's the ambition. It's what it took on. You know, the balls that those people had to take on what they took on. Live, but drama. You know, drama.
Yeah.
On radio.
Yeah.
You know, who does that? Very few people.
Which was one of the goals they set themselves from the very beginning when they went on the air in 49.
Yes.
And they found it was very expensive and very time-consuming to do, but they continued to do it as often as they could.
But, you know, the thing that keeps, that keeps repeating in my memory, as I listen to college radio stations and commercial radio stations, FM stations, in Los Angeles, and I certainly remember in New York and in Boston where I grew up, and every place else, and WFMT in Chicago, which I've heard a good, lot of, and now I have it on a satellite hookup, so I hear it all the time. They really are Bush League. You know, you can tell the announcers, they don't pronounce their composers like they used to, which is another way of saying is they don't pronounce them correctly. I mean, the music that is programmed, the total lack of public affairs programming, news programming, except in a rip and read, wire service copy. If there's nothing there, I mean, there are live concerts, which is nice, but there's nothing there. And you think of the standards of excellence and the ambition of a listener supported station like KPFA, and it's not just, again, I keep thinking I must be romanticizing all of this. I must be leaving out the negatives because it couldn't have been that good. But I looked at a folio, yesterday, and I couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
One program after the other. What richness, what extraordinary diversity, what extraordinary class.
Yeah.
Sophisticated radio of a kind that has been unique in my experience.
And on Classic FM, the Time Warner, the classic pop station in London, I recently heard Alberato del Grazioso pronounced three different ways in the course of one broadcast.
I hope they made it eventually correctly.
Yeah, I think somebody got onto it. The last time was pretty close.
But again, there's another thing. No concession to commerciality. Mm-hmm. You know, that's something. We talked yesterday about how the whole world, particularly in the arts and in the communications world, has gone so commercial and so lowest common denominator that it's a faint shadow of what it used to be, and its ambitions don't exist anymore. But here was a station. How did they fundraise? Did they used to do it on the air? Did they do it marathons?
Marathons did not come in until later.
Later,
on.
But you know that.
But they did ask for money.
Yeah, I'll tell you something. We're public television. Public radio asks for money in such an offensive way, you know, where everything stops dead in its tracks. And in the case of PBS, we're all on to their trick, which is to save the best programming for the fundraising times, which is really perverse.
Well, KPFK haven't even learned that. They just start fundraising.
Yeah.
And being as even more boring than usual.
Yes.
Drive you straight off the air.
But in the early '60s, I don't have any recollection of their hustling for support among their listeners in the same way that others do it now. In the very idea that the pretentiousness of public television and public radio in terms of we are superior to anything you can get anyplace else. Well, it might be true, but who wants their nose rubbed in it? There was never a sense, maybe it's Berkeley, maybe it's California, there was never a sense of smugness or superiority, which is in terms of tone, mm-hmm. which is something that unfortunately now, you know, the combination of the kinds of things we're talking about carries with it a snobbishness and an arrogance, which is really almost worth turning off for. But it never was the case at KPFA.
I actually did the first pre-recorded commercial plug on KPFA, on a tape that you put on the air.
Really?
Yep. And it consisted of two excerpts from Gawain and the Green Knight.
Oh my.
Fading into each other, followed by the announcement, Sex and Violence, both available in Middle English on KPFA for $24 a year.
Don't get that very often, do you? Yeah.
Well, it was glorious. And the more that I look into it all these years later, the more my feelings are corroborated.
Yeah. How long did it last?
Well, that's a difficult thing to answer because fragments of it survive to this day.
Do they?
Yeah.
That's encouraging.
And there are individual programs. Now, for instance, Charles Scheer, who was a fine music director, came after you in the middle 1960s into the late 1960s, mm-hmm. is still doing a program, a morning.
See, there's another thing I forgot to mention, tradition, mm-hmm. continuity.
Yeah.
You know, because you know, you said you did Treasury of the 78 after I
mm-hmm.
left.
Yeah.
You know, it's the idea of passing on mm-hmm. something that is precious to you to the next generation, which is non-existent anyplace mm-hmm. else. That's important. That's very important, mm-hmm. I think, because because the station as an institution mm-hmm. becomes an educational institution as well for the people who are involved. I certainly, as a volunteer, you know, I found myself learning more about my subject as I tackled mm-hmm. it for air.
Yeah.
And I think that's important.
Yeah. And another aspect of Treasury of the 78, insofar as there was a respect for the repertoire of the past, it tended to be more or less exclusively operatic performances of the past. If you heard it on the radio, Anthony Boucher's Golden Voices.
Forgive me, I left out one of the programs and one of the people that I remember the best when I was mentioning all the wonderful richness. Insert that if you ever use it. Anthony Boucher's Golden Voices. You know what a wonderful man he was, and what a collection, and what learning about the subject. I mean, I found spending time with him, you know, taught me as much about the subject as, you know, anybody.
Yeah. And you know, there was somebody not before him, but before you and contemporaneous with him. Does the name Byron Bryant mean anything?
I remember that, right? Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Now, he did his own series. He had a remarkable record collection of going back to Cylinders.
Right.
And a great scholar, a historian.
Yeah.
And a fine, distinguished voice mm-hmm. on the air.
Mm-hmm.
And he did a series called Songs Our Fathers Heard,
yes.
which was a history of popular music from the turn of the century
mm-hmm.
onwards.
Mm-hmm.
And Phil Elwood, by the way,
I have to tell you.
Phil Elwood inherited Byron Bryant's entire record collection when Byron died.
Mm-hmm. You know, again, everybody there was turned on to everyone else. I mean, that may, by the way, actually be true.
Yeah.
But I didn't know about it. I was young in those days.
Yeah.
Phil
Elwood still has a regular program on KPFA.
But everybody was an aficionado
mm-hmm.
of something.
Mm-hmm.
And there was always someone there, coming into that as a volunteer, there was always someone there who shared your enthusiasm for something. And eventually, you know, you either worked with that person or passed it on to that person or inherited it from that person. And that was it's that wonderful, platonic ideal of the academy. It was part of an academic tradition, you know, and of course, mm-hmm. being in Berkeley, it should have been, but it never is.
Yeah.
I found, I hear that there were many jealousies and political factions and things. I never was aware of them because people were so damn busy producing, mm-hmm. yeah. you know, what they produced with the very limited resources they had and the people that they had, mm-hmm. that I never was aware of that kind of, you know, activity.
There were crises that came to a head from time to time.
Yeah,
And then there could be even something as dire as a strike and half the people walking out.
Yeah.
And it had happened in 1953, just a few years after KPFA went on the air.
Mm-hmm.
It continued. But it wasn't the most typical thing that happened on the air. If it had been, they never would have survived.
Yeah. But, you know, it's interesting. I was in Berkeley last year and on a periodical trip to Northern California, and I got into my car, my rented car from the airport, and made my way across the Bay Bridge, and I was flipping around the dial, and boy, I knew when I hit KPFA that I was there. I knew it. Even after years of not hearing it, I knew that I was back, because it has as distinctive a point of view and a sound and the kind of programming that it had that you couldn't miss it.
When it was wonderful, you always knew. When it was terrible, you always knew.
Sure. I mean, it's like when we turned on KPFK yesterday, and we heard some squally folk singer singing some ethnic folk song from some, you know, subcountry.
Mm-hmm. Unaccompanied.
Exactly. And as you said, quite rightly, that must be KPFK. So, I mean, it, you know, we laugh at it, but there it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, my God. You've said so much that's useful.
Thank you.
Is there anything I haven't asked you that I should have asked you?
I'm trying to think. It was only 2 years. I mean, in a long history. Mm-hmm. But I like to think that it was the golden years.
You put it actually within a cultural context in a very useful way, and you will be extensively quoted from.
Well, always pleasant. But they were wonderful times. They were troubled times. They were crazy times. But mm-hmm. but generally speaking, the Bay Area and Berkeley, particularly in those years, you know, was a wonderful place to be.
It was the best of times, it was the worst
of
times.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, it was the worst of times in the sense of what was to follow.
Yeah.
And the fact that Berkeley sort of never recovered in the way, you know, that, I mean, God, how can you ever forget the place, you know, where you first saw Citizen Kane in a movie theater at the Cinema Guild and Studio in a beautiful new print, you know, in the days when that was, you know, was hard to come by.
Even if Pauline did go on to denigrate Orson Welles' contribution to it.
Listen, she was entitled. And apparently she was right, too, but that's... according to the family of Herman Mankiewicz. And to hear the first American performances of Frau und Schatten, to be, you know, witness, you know, for Joan Sutherland's American debut at the opera, to hear the repertory and the artists from Central Europe that Adler brought to this country, the conductors who never conducted anyplace else, but only in San Francisco, to have seen the city before, Rockefeller, destroyed the view from the Bay Bridge with all of those skyscrapers. You know, the price of making downtown San Francisco a financial center and a world-class city was the heavenly look of San Francisco, which I'll never forget. I mean, I used to get on the bus from Berkeley to go to the opera, and I'd, you know, at twilight, going over the Bay Bridge, and being able to see this incredible city. You can only see it now to the right side of the city, you know, the Coit Tower area and Russian Hill and everything else, because everything's, you know, blocked in with skyscrapers. But then there weren't any. Ah, oh, what a beautiful place. And it, you know, for someone like me coming from the East, the freedom, the lack of pretentiousness, the welcoming that I got as a volunteer, Lord knows, off the street, literally, you know, with a certain amount of background, but off the street, coming into this place and being, you know, assigned things. Where else could that happen? You know, unique, totally unique.
Yeah. Well, there were people there who had, I think, a fine nose for talent. Since their decisions were in no way based on commercial considerations, the last question that anybody ever asked was, will it sell?
No. That was irrelevant.
Yeah. But the phrase that I keep using about that place is, and the reason that so many people came through so well, was because it was one of the few places of either volunteering or employment in which one could afford the luxury of habitual integrity.
Yes.
You never had to ask the question, is this going to cost me my job?
Mm-mm. Now, the standards were higher there than probably at any other time and place, in my experience. Mm-hmm.